You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Email. Hey, Mac, what are the odds that ass clown Trump goes ahead and screws up all the credibility he got from that speech he gave last night, tonight in Phoenix? Question mark. Well, I'd say 100%. He can't help himself, you know? And let me tell you, if he can go to Phoenix and acquit himself well and kind of like in a presidential manner, it's a watershed event, right? But he can't. He normally can't do that. So, good luck. You know, John Waite, missing you. How desperate I've become. Waiting to hear from the gunner. Another email. You can text the program if you want to. Yeah. I kid you not. You can find all that kind of stuff. All you got to do is click on Contact the Show. Go to the website, click on Contact the Show. And then it says Call the Show. 714-661-8107. That's the text number, too. That's the secret text line. Yeah, it is. So feel free. Use it. Montana man wants to know, is the gunner UA? Well, I don't normally call the gunner until about 9:05. So, but I sent him a text about 5 minutes ago. He has an answer. So he could just be out in the garage, you know, screwing off. But he may have had a meltdown because of the video I sent him. Like I said, Mike hates that senior enlisted people are in no way, shape, or form held accountable for anything. And the video I posted for my buddies to watch is hilarious because he can't figure out why relieve the command's master chief, though. He doesn't have anything to do with the leadership of the ship. Oh, my God, it's hilarious. It's absolutely hilarious. Now, I don't know if the gunner saw that. We're going to find out right now. All right, so you're going to get to hear the greetings and salutations of Michael Musselman. So he just checked in.
What's up?
Joining me now from Granbury, Texas, is the one and only Michael Musselman. Gunner, what's up? How you doing?
What's going on?
Nothing. Did you watch the video I sent you?
Yeah, but once the guy in the patio.
Yeah. Okay, let me tell you why he sent that, okay? How much do you hate it when senior enlisted people don't get held accountable for anything? Can you put that into words?
They want to be part of it and tell that anger down, and they have nothing to do with it. They want all the responsibility, they want all the respect, but none of the responsibility.
So this guy muses like, yeah, but why would they relieve the command master chief? Just because we collided and there's probably some crazy shit going, like, what is, right, Mike? What does he have to do with anything?
And he's got a title. He's part of the command master. But it's got a lot of feedback.
I watched that, And I swear to God, I start laughing because I'm thinking of you. I said, man, when Mike sees this, he's going to, like, his head will go, oh, shit. Because it is, this guy, he sits on his front porch drinking a beer, I think in Kentucky, and he's musing about these different people that either got relieved or didn't get relieved, and he keeps coming back to, but I don't get it, man. The Command Master Chief, what does he have to do with anything? Nothing, right? Oh, man, so I was, just so, you know, I was thinking about you. So, anyway, I thought
it just pissed me off again. Because, I mean, they want to be part of the command group, but when command's good, they don't want any responsibility.
Yeah. So, to me, it's like, yeah, when you're going to get them, send a message, do a little message sending, get everybody. Yeah, you're all responsible. So, anyway, so did you watch the president's speech last night?
No.
What?
No, I did not. Nope. Don't listen to it. Was it good?
Yeah, it was blue. It was a Blue Diamond speech.
Oh, really?
Yes.
What do you mean, Blue Diamond speech?
Well, who do you think wrote it? Who do you think wrote it for him?
Kelly.
Mattis Kelly Dunford. Yeah, it said all the right things, man. Pakistan got put on notice. Hey, you need to help or, you know, you're going to be in trouble. There isn't just a military solution. There's an economic piece to this, too. But, you know, there was some stuff said about the rules of engagement. Did you find the rules of engagement when we were there to be restrictive?
No, not really.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I made a comment like, hey, look, Rudy and I, Schwarz, I mean, we were rules of engagement guys every day. And Mike, and I even remember the story of you talking about being in firefights where you looked at Marines and said, what are you shooting at? Mike.
Yeah, that was all the time, though.
And tell what would the typical response be?
Yeah, because the other guys were shooting. And it was just this, what the hell is going on?
That's why you need grown-ups in the area, all right? That's why you need grown-ups in the area. Because, you know, for instance, and I told a story earlier, so forgive me if I'm repeating this, but, you know, Mike has a patrol, and it's pinned down by automatic weapons fire, right? Right? So that's hair on fire shit, right? But when you have some experience, you say, are you in a compound? Are you in a ditch? Are you going to take casualties? Oh, we're in a compound. Okay, well, that takes, because if they're going to take casualties, we can kill anybody we need to. If we have to drop a compound on their civilians, like, that's unfortunate, but it happens. But we don't have to allow Americans to be killed and in that situation. The rules of engagement allow us to defend. But part of being a smart guy in a complicated war is having some experience and some savvy, and you're head in the game. And
right.
And so the rules of engagement, in my opinion, it stopped inexperienced guys from doing stupid shit that got civilians killed that ultimately made your life more difficult. So I don't know if they've changed since 2011. I would imagine they have. I don't know if they've become more restricted. But when we were there, you know, you heard the same people bitching back in the United States. Oh, we hear the rules of engagement are horrible. Whoa. Like, no, they're fine. What? What? No, they're fine. Okay? We can kill whoever we need to kill. So, anyway, no, it was a good speech, man. It points us in the right direction to, and then, you know, putting people on notice that there's not just a military solution. Even left the door open for a political negotiations with the Taliban,
right.
And maybe someday when the security piece is put in place, that maybe there can be some negotiations, but I don't know if that'll ever happen. So, I mean, honestly, I thought it was about as good as you could do. It's going to be conditions-based, not time-based, and it's not going to be, right?
That's a plus.
Yeah, so... No, so it was good, and it had Blue Diamond written all over it. So, anyway, So what have you been, good. Yeah, so what have you been doing?
Today, drinking my coffee.
Yeah.
You know, hey, I got a lot of feedback when I talk. I can hear myself again on here.
Okay, hold on a second. So, can you hear yourself now? Say something.
Let's see. Yep.
Okay. Can you hear yourself now?
Let's see. Nope. That's fixed it.
Bingo. Who's your daddy?
Yeah, you got to figure this stuff out, man. Technology in the hands of the wrong user.
No, it's called a mix minus. It's like, for instance, you come on and I send your voice down to all these other voices, and I send, like, when Rob's on a different line, I send his voice down to everybody else, and so I hadn't unscrewed that yet, so I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
There's probably a YouTube video out there on how to use it.
No, there's really not. It's too complicated for YouTube. You know, one of the things that I watched last night was the video of the USS McCain. You don't see the McCain because we don't squawk so that commercial satellites can pick us up, United States Navy ships. We squawk encrypted stuff, so only our satellites pick up our stuff. So you see the ship that the McCain ran into? Yeah, it's only driving straight for about 30 miles at like 10 knots. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't really know what happened, but
you know, the guy on your video brought out one good point that I really, you know, was the fact that the Fitzgerald only received, what, 2 Batalees in its whole time that it's been off. That, to me, is astonishing, man.
Oh, shit, man. The Ranger had never won one until I got onto it, and then we won one. The only one the Ranger ever won. One. Were you on the Kitty Hawk or the Constellation?
Kitty.
The shitty Kitty.
We got a Battle E when I was on board.
That thing was a scow, and you know it.
But we got a Battle E the first year I was on.
There you go. So we got one too, and the Ranger never got one. But it's interesting how ships gain reputations, and for instance, the Carl Vinson was known as just a dirty ship. Like, what do you mean? Like, what's that? It's dirty. And the Ranger, they had a fire on it off the coast of Vietnam. And so, yo, the Danger Ranger, that thing catches on fire all the time. Yo, bro, that happened in 1969, okay?
Right.
Yeah, well, we saw the movie and the damage control. And let me tell you, the movie's incredible. Do you remember seeing that, Mike, with the ordnance? There's an aircraft on the catapult. And it somehow catches fire on the catapult. And the pilots are trying to get out. They're trying to extinguish it. And then something explodes. I think it's fuel explodes. Then ordnance starts to explode. And then it just goes from there. And then it spreads into the hangar bay. And it's just crazy. But what you see in these damage control videos are these sailors, I want to say 4 different attempts to get at that aircraft. And each attempt ending in an explosion of either a 500-pound bomb, and you see people go flying. And you see the balls of these guys on the flight deck trying to fight this fire. Pretty amazing.
Right.
Do you remember seeing that?
No, and I knew about it, but I never saw it.
Yeah. So, but ships, they get reputations, and they don't shake them, so. Anyway, all right. So the Battle E, yeah, that guy. But anyway, this guy, I don't know, probably 20-year enlisted, got out as a petty officer, first class, and he was a helmsman, right? Which meant he steered the ship. And so he's sitting on his porch in Kentucky, I think, and he's drinking a beer, musing about this, and he makes his own YouTube video, and it's just, oh my God, it had me laughing. Because, like I said, and I could hear Mike just screaming when he starts talking about the Command Master Chief. He got nothing to do with anything. Why is he getting relieved? And I thought, oh, man, Gunner's got to see this. So, anyway, President's going to Phoenix today. That's going on. What's going on in Texas? Anything exciting in Texas?
No, just hot.
Ooh, how hot today?
hot enough.
Yeah, I saw it was going to, it was 84 like 2 hours ago. So I saw that. I was like, ooh, going to be hot today in Texas. Does the triple digits?
Yeah, I think so. I think either that or, I mean, it's kind of one of those, it feels like it type of things.
So how much longer is this going to last? Into October? Mid-September?
Hopefully towards September it starts getting a little cooler, but it'll go, it should, about late September it starts cooling down to where it's comfortable again.
Email. Hey, Mac, I've got a question, and he's probably answered this before, so forgive me for being stupid. In a firefight, getting shot at, what's the hardest thing to do?
Communicate. I mean, to get people to fire what they should be firing, not what they think they are. And, you know, it's just communication is the hardest thing to get. Because it goes out the window, man, when everybody gets tunnel visioned and what they think is the threat. And then once you get, you understand where the threat's coming from, and then it's just simple tactics after that, you know? Shoot, cover, put their heads down, and then maneuver on them.
Is communicating harder than finding out where whoever's shooting at you is shooting from? Which problems are harder to solve?
The communication problem
is harder.
Yeah, that's the most difficult. You know, trying to get the information out to everybody where your fire is coming from, or what they perceive the fire become, because someone might see something different.
Right.
You may see that, you know, that it's going, this is happening or that's happening. So, and it's all that communication, all that information coming into again one guy, and then having him make a decision.
Interesting little email here. Mac, interesting question. My question for the gunner is, it's been a long time since I've been in a Marine rifle squad. When I was in one, nobody had a radio. I've seen pictures where it looks like non-commissioned officers are wearing some kind of headset because there's a microphone or something that looks like a microphone close to their mouth. Could he explain how a platoon communicates? Do squads have radios? How far down do those radios go? Do team leaders have headsets? I'm curious because it sounds like that would facilitate some of this communication. We simply yelled as loud as we could and pointed when we'd make contact. But it looks like that's changed. Mike?
Well, okay, so interesting. I was reading an article yesterday, so Gunner Chris Wade, who replaced me in Quantico, for this whole, and I worked on integrated communications, combat communications with Mercury Systems Command and some other groups, and we were trying to solve it, and it always came down to, it's going to cost a lot of money to put headsets and radios on every guy. And so the question was always, okay, alright. I mean, when you look at Special Force guys, every single guy is calmed up. Everybody can talk to everybody. So usually in a perfect world, if you have a squad of guys, all the Marines are going to have headsets and they can talk inner squad. So it's just mechanics after that. If you want a push button communication, so you push a button and then you can talk, or is it, you know, voice activated as soon as you start talking. And then the squad leader, he's going to have a different radio where he can have, he'll have two channels and he can talk to his guys and then one up. So he'll talk to his platoon. And then your platoon sergeant and your platoon guys, platoon commander will talk to everybody in the platoon, you know, that they need to talk to, and then the company. And then, you know, so there's one, what level you're at, and then one up, on the communication side. So, you know, that's the perfect world, and 1/6 is actually the first time 6 Marines is doing this experiment where they gave, I think it's a squad, basically everybody in the squad, it has IARs or suppressors on them, these different helmets that have the headset built into them, so everybody can talk, and what they're finding out is they're a better squad than everybody else in the battalion. You know, it's like, duh. I mean, when everybody can talk and everybody can communicate and everybody gets the information real time, so you're not screaming and yelling and you're not having a guy run down the line and pass the information, you know, everybody gets it real time. So when the squad leader talks, everybody's listening and everybody starts moving or everybody starts firing. So, you know, this whole inner squad has to be figured out. We tried to do it on cheap back in the day. We had these, you know, interpersonal radios, you know, that would just suck ass. They had probably like, you know, 100 feet of range on them. They're cumbersome. They weren't reliable. You had a headset. You had like a little thing that went over your ear, and you had a microphone. And so you had all these other competing interests, you know, this with noise reduction and everything else around you. With these headphone systems, they're basically like Bose noise canceling systems. They're state of the art, and they drown out everything else. They also have these audible little things, so you can actually hear things going on around you. You can adjust that too. So it's a great situational awareness tool if it's used correctly. But again, it allows for the squad to, or those guys unit for instant situational awareness.
So right now, the way the Marine Corps is configured, it's squad leader, team leaders have headsets. And obviously the platoon commander and on up. And would you say 1-6 is experimenting with every Marine comm'd up?
Yeah, I think it's a platoon, but I know it's definitely a squad where everybody in that squad has a comm system and can talk.
Wow.
A real good, reliable system.
Yeah, that actually would work when you needed it to. Let me, just those guys being able to hear, not even maybe necessarily needing to talk, but I mean, certainly if they needed to, that would be a good thing. But if they could hear what was going on, their situational awareness goes through the roof. You know, they could still, they could still yell at each other even if they couldn't speak. But you know, just as Mike said, trying to get them to talk on to the target. Right, what's going on is, you know.
Well, you have 26 eyes looking at different things. I mean, right. And then feeding it into the system. Yeah, it's magnificent when it works well and it's used properly. You know, and again, that's no brainer, man. I mean, and it was based on money. You know, that's what curtailed the system was. You know, geez, we're going to give the infantrymen $1,000 comm system. I mean, like. It's just money, boys.
That's all right. We got lots of that. And besides, aren't we tired of the aviators just flushing it down the toilet?
Oh, my God. They abuse it such a horrible way.
Right. I had a friend. Listen to this story. I had a mutual friend tell us that they were working with another branch of the service that does an awful lot of aviation. And they flew out to a base to do some work, and he said he went to meet him, and there was all these cars in the parking lot, and so he's standing there waiting, and he's like, "Hey, who are you?" "Oh, I'm the LNO from the base here." "And who's that?" I'm the Alamo rental car guy." "They got some rental cars?" "Yeah, I've got 45 rental cars out there." And there's like 90 people coming. And he said, "What?" He said, "Yeah, that way they'll all have cars." And so they're talking. He's like, "Are they staying on base?" And like, "No, they're staying out in town at the Sheraton."
Yeah.
And like, Mike, so let's just say 90 Marines were going to deploy in support of something to another base. Where would we stay, and who'd get rental cars? And this is no shit, everybody. Listen to this.
If what now?
If 90 Marines were going to another base, let's just pick one. Let's just say we were going to Camp Roberts to support some event at Camp Roberts in Central California. The Army's got this right. So who would? No, Camp Roberts is not good. Fort Ord is better because it's close to nice stuff. where would we stay at Fort Ord, or would we stay out in town, and who would get a rental car?
Yeah, oh, that's easy. The Marines would stay somewhere like in a hangar, and you'd get one rental car. And it'd be a four-door sedan.
That's right. And here's the sad part is, we'd be like fired up as all shit because we got a rental car, right? Hey, we got a rental
car.
Yeah. We got a rental car.
Yeah. And, you know, now the Air Force goes PAD, you know, 90 guys in the Air Force go PAD. Do you know how many rental cars they get? 90.
This is no bullshit either.
I mean, and they stay in town at the Hilton or something.
Yeah, and people think like, oh, you guys are just bullshit. You guys are just saying this stuff. No, that's like the God's honest, man. That's like what a fucked up culture the Marine Corps is relative to life. Other services do it completely different.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I had been on deployments when I was this young enlisted guy. We go places, do different missions, and we stayed in one time we stayed in a frickin' hangar, a deserted hangar on cot, you know, and there was one restroom, had like two shitters and a urinal and one shower for like 80 guys. But they did give us a van, and it wasn't a rental van, it was an Air Force van, like a 14-passenger capacity van.
And we took that back to him with two tires left and all the windows knocked out. That's the way the Marine Corps. But it's such a cultural difference. It's hilarious. I remember the first time we went out with IOC, we went up to Andrews and we were waiting for our C-130 to fly us out to 29 Palms. And so the Air Force guys come to us and they say, well, you know, we've got some substandard housing that you guys can spend the night in because our flight got delayed. And we're like, well, we don't care what it is. We don't care what it is. And they're like, so next morning, right, everybody gathers together. And the Marines are like, and we had enlisted Marines from EI Company at the basic school going with us. And they're laughing. And you're like, what's so funny? And like, hey, sir, there's substandard housing better than our barracks. And they were like laughing their ass out. And we're like, what? Yes, sir, their shit is nice. It's nice. Or it's like, we laughed when we walked in there. This is their substandard stuff that they won't allow their guys to live in anymore. And it's nicer than our shit that we think is not bad. Oh my God!
Yeah,
so funny. All right, I'm gonna give you. Are you ready for your history quiz?
Sure.
Okay. All right. Who was the first major nation to ban slavery, and what year was it? And I don't not banning the traders, sure. not banning banning slave of trades, but banning slavery.
Yeah. Shit, it wasn't us, was it?
Oh, hell no, it wasn't us. It wasn't us, no. We were 30 years later.
I'd say it was Britain then.
Okay, give me a year. Oh, I gave it away.
So I got it right. Britain,
yeah.
Let's see. Wait. We were slave, 1800.
1833. So, and the reason I got interested in that is that like trying to evaluate like Washington and Jefferson and people like that. I mean, look, Jefferson dies in 1827, and the largest power on the planet still allows slavery. Okay, only Spain in 1811 had outlawed slavery as a nation. Okay, but Britain, France, all the other major nations on the planet still allowed it. Washington frees his slaves upon his death, and as does Jefferson. So in this kind of discussion about these guys are pieces of shit and blah 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 blah, it's like, hey, look, what do you know about slavery? Right. So I I've learned stuff that I didn't know, and it's actually kind of interesting. You know, in terms of this is how the world was. It sucked. If you were black and if you lived on the African continent, you were probably going to get yoked up and sold and sent someplace else. I think the biggest destination for slaves from Africa was Brazil, who didn't outlaw slavery till 1888. So it's interesting that the largest slave ports in the United States, Baltimore, Charleston, and New Orleans, are three of the top four. I can't remember the fourth one for the life of me. So just interesting in this whole discussion about our history and whatnot. So anyway. All right. So, congratulations on the history quiz. Well done.
Thank you.
All right. We have a text question from Montana Man. What's it take to win a Battle E? Mike?
You have to get it in. There's different areas of things you have to pass. So, like engineering, I know is one. What's the damage control? You know, to qualify for the Battle E, ship must win a minimum of four of the six Command Excellence Awards.
Wow. And the commands.
So it's got to win. Maritime warfare,
right.
Engineering survivability,
okay.
And control, logistics, and safety, and efficiency.
What is it?
So you have to win four of those. And each one of those, so on the ship, you'd have these different colored E's on your ship. And like the black E was the maritime warfare, the red E was engineering. Command and control was the green E, logistics was the blue E, and safety was the yellow E. Purple E was efficiency. So you had to win four of those events.
I didn't know that. They paint that on the side of the ship.
Yep.
Yeah. But when you win a Battle E, it's an actual ribbon, and they paint the ribbon on the side of the ship. So, yeah.
Right. If you win five, you get a wreath around the E.
Boom. Yeah, that means you're somebody. Yeah, the Ranger had never won a Battle E till I got on that thing, and I laid the wood to that scow. I tightened that shit up.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, the Kitty Hawk, I just looked, Kitty Hawk had three E's in her service.
And how long? Probably 40 years worth of, 40 plus years.
Yeah, something like that.
Service. Same for the Ranger. Hold on, here's an email. Mac, I'm curious, was Mike good with spit shine and waxing blue tile? Mike, first of all, tell everybody what blue tile is on a naval warship.
It denotes officer country.
Right.
Officers walk on blue tile because they're not good enough to walk on green tile.
Right.
It might screw up their shoes, yeah.
Yeah, and most of the time, the Admiral's blue tile is taken care of by Marines, because sailors can't wax like Marines wax.
Here's the story about me. So my ship CO was a Marine fighter pilot in Vietnam.
Whoa.
And then when the Marines downsized, they were getting rid of a lot of them. He was one of the guys. So they gave him an option to transfer to the Navy. So he did, because he wanted to fly. And so he became a naval aviator, and then eventually became the CEO of my aircraft carrier. But he was so proud, and he remembers when you walked into his stateroom, most of the things hanging on his wall were memorabilia when he was a Marine pilot. And, you know, so he loved Marines. He loved everything about them. He would come down and hang out in our Berlin area. You know, he was just a really great guy. When we'd go, so he abolished all that stuff. He didn't want any of his Marines on his ship to do any blue tile. He had the Navy guys do it.
Are you shitting me? My guys were doing blue tile all the time. And then what would happen is the Navy fucks that would walk through it, and you weren't supposed to transit through the blue tile, you're supposed to go around, they'd scuff it up and fuck it up. And like, I remember somebody.
Oh, no. See, the Navy guys on our ship feared us. man. They would see us just walking down the corridor. They would just pull off to the side and just wait for us to walk by. They feared us. There was
back in the day, you could do some damage, and then were you a good spit shotter?
When I was on a Navy vessel, yeah. But when I was in the regular Marine Corps, I would drop my boots off out in town to some Filipino lady, and she'd do them, like, they get done, like, with, like, quarter frame.
Oh, really?
You know, so it was, like $10. And then that spit shine would last, like, 30 days. So I had my field boots, and then I had my garrison boots.
Right. Back in the day when you did that kind of shit. Spit shining. Marines. On sea duty, man. That was the deal. You know, you went to sea school and you learned how to be a seagoing Marine but the things that Marines got used for. The ship surgeon on the Ranger when I was on it was a former, I think he was an infantry officer, maybe an Artie guy. No, he was an infantry officer in Vietnam, first lieutenant, and then he came home, got out, went to medical school, and came back in the Navy. And so I remember my first day on the ship. I'm having lunch probably in the wardroom. I fly out to meet the ship because it's off the coast. I'm having lunch with my replacement, and he comes walking over. Who's this? And I look up and I stand up. Sir, I'm Mike McNamara. He goes, What are you doing here? I'm the XO's replacement. He goes, and the XO was an engineer, the CO was an arty guy. And he goes, tell me you're a grunt. I said, I'm a grunt, sir. And he goes, God damn it, it's about time. So, and you know, he's a first lieutenant, Vietnam platoon commander, man. He was a baller. And same kind of stuff. So one day I see the ship's master at arms. So when you're a part of the Marine detachment, you work with the masters at arms. He was the chief, he was a master's arm chief. And so he comes walking down the hallway, and he's got this huge bandage on like the outside of his bicep between like the base of his shoulder and his elbow. And I said, what happened? He goes, I don't know if I want to tell you. And I said, are you okay? Because the bandage is huge. And he said, my wife left me. And I said, what? And he said, yeah, I just got this Dear John letter. Like, we've been married for like 15 years, and she left me. She told me that she sold our house and she's moving out, and then she's not going to be there when I get home. And I said, yeah. What's that have to do with the bandage? He said, well, I had her name tattooed on my arm. And I said, and? He said, the doc cut the tattoo off and sewed it back together. I said, what? He said, yeah, he cut that bit. He said he cut that bitch's name right out of my arm. I couldn't live with it. And I just went, you got to be shitting me. So I go down the passageway. Now I got to find Barnaby to find out if this is true. And I walk in, and he looks at me and goes, oh, what the hell are you doing in here? I said, did you cut the chief's wife's name, the tattoo, off his arm? He goes, it'll grow back. He said, shit, we have way worse injuries in Vietnam. He said, skin stretches, he'll be all right. He said, but he told me he couldn't live with that bitch's name on his ass anymore. So,
oh, my God.
Exactly. And you're like, you got to be shitting me. But it was awesome. It was awesome. He, in fact, this guy, I can't remember if it was Singapore or Hong Kong, on the way home. And the captain of the ship said, look, you couldn't bring certain type of wood back onto the ship. And because the CO was afraid that there'd be worms in it or something. You know how they say that shit, Mike, right? So this guy confiscates every piece of wood that came back on the ship, guys on Liberty. And, I mean, it was a huge stack in the hangar bay of different wood shit that all these guys had brought back. And then the CO got back on ship. He was like, what the fuck is going on? Yeah. Chief so-and-so. Like, yeah. I don't know. I look back. I enjoy it. I mean, you see shit on a ship going, when you're going around the world that you'll never see the rest of your life. And it's a different experience because you're only, you know, probably, what, Mike, 60 Marines in a Marine detachment back in the day? Something like that?
Yeah, I think it was, something around 60, 65, something like that.
Hey, tell everybody, so what we do is we guard the special weapons, right? Can't confirm or deny that they ever existed on the ship, but we could tell you that that's what we did. Mike, what happened? And so every week you do drills, and the Marines leave the Marine detachment area. They don't know if it's a drill or not. So
I didn't have special weapons on my boat.
You didn't?
No, they took them off, and all we did was, we did vessel boarding, search and seizure. So when we were at sea, we'd board unflagged tankers and inspect them and then let them go or seize them if they had contraband.
That's good. That had to be fun, yes.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was a lot of fun, but it was pretty boring most of the time because you'd have to wait for a ship.
Right. What about did you guys not do drills?
No, we didn't have nukes. No.
Okay, so when you have nukes,
we did drills. The only drills that we did were like on the security worker side was shooter. You know, like if you're in port, someone boards the vessel
right. That's
not supposed to be there, or just things like that we reacted to, but not like the nuclear weapon drills. No.
So what happens is, it was COMNAV AIRPAC instruction says that you have to do a drill every week, and that when they come out of the berthing area, they have to be, their weapons are condition one, and they don't know it's a drill. And the whole ship gets briefed that when they hear operation, and every ship's got a different name, that the sailors and the ship's company knows when they see Marines to get on the deck and put their hands up. And if you don't get on the deck, that means that you're not supposed to be here, and they would slam the shit out of these guys. And Mike's talking about they were afraid of us, and we lived under the forward mess deck, and we wouldn't normally schedule a drill during mess hours.
No.
But when something would happen, somebody would bump a hatch or something like that and set off an alarm. Oh my God! They would come out of.
We had all of that stuff. Yeah, we had all the alarm systems built into our response force.
Right.
The facility back there yet.
Right, and there's a certain number of guys had to be there in 3 minutes. Certain number had to be there in five, and certain number had to be there in 10. And that's how that shit worked. And the Marines, when those alarms would go off during chow hours, they would come out of there and they would knock people everywhere.
You couldn't leave your berthing area, even if you're off duty, without being armed.
What?
So, yeah, every time, even when, if you left to go to chow and you weren't on duty, your section wasn't on duty, you still had to be armed.
Really?
Yeah, because if you're at chow and something happens, they need backup. You can't run back
right to
the response, the RFF, I think they call it, and pick up your gear and then go. So we always had our body armor on, always had our weapon, our long rifle on, and then we always had a pistol on.
Wow. Did you used to do the paymaster thing when back in the day? You were on sea duty when they had paymasters, right?
Yep. Yeah, we had guys that were there armed. Yep, escorting them.
they would show up when you'd have these Marines with shotguns, and the paymaster would show up and he'd pay everybody. Yeah, he had a big can of money.
But one of our duties, Mac, you're gonna crack up, man. Was we were. When we left Norfolk, we were going back to San Diego, back to our home port. We were in Philadelphia in dry dock going through the SLEP program, the Service Life Extension program. We went to Norfolk, did all our carrier quals off the coast of Virginia, and then once we got qualled, we left with a very small contingent of just fighters on our deck just to go around San Diego. But we had the cargo, you know, the COD planes, the ones that flew like the mail and all the information, like the prop planes. And we had a small contingent of aircraft on our boat, but not just enough to defend us. So we left, and just prior to leaving, we got word that they were going to experiment and put women, Navy women on board. So we were one of the first capital ships of that size to have female sailors go to sea.
Whoa.
Yeah. So we had probably about 40 girls that they cleared out one area, one berthing area. It was just off the hangar deck and had like one entrance, one exit out of the place. And they put us in charge of the guard. So we had a table right outside their door, right outside their ass, with a Marine post 24/7 that we wouldn't allow Navy guys to go in. To make a long story short, out of the women that were on board, all of them were dating Marines. And so, I mean, it was such a fun trip. I mean, it was just so freaking funny, man, where you're going to lunch and you're meeting your girlfriend, she's on the boat, and then all the Marines are sitting with girls at the chow hall, and the sailors hated us for it, man.
Hey, when you got to secure something, you got to lock it down.
Yeah, you can't have any access to it.
No access to it. There was no women on ships when I was there, but I want to say the subtenders. And the supply.
Yeah, subtenders had them.
Subtenders had them for some reason, and so did, I think, some of the supply ships had them. And they would tell these stories about having dances and things like that, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
When I was in England, one of our jobs was, because the nuclear submarines would come into Holy Rock, Scotland, and the USS Simon Lake was a subtender, and that ship was firmly moored in Holy Rock. So these boomers would come into the Holy Rock, which was like a big channel, a river going up to the port. And every once in a while, she'd go to sea to do tender work on a submarine at sea, a nuke. And even if it was a boomer or a fast attack, but a nuclear fast attack, they had to have Marines on board. So one time I got detailed to go up with, there was six Marines. And we were the security force. The Simon Lake went to sea for like a month. And the ship was like 90% women.
What?
Yeah. And the six of us on board.
It's like a James Bond movie.
I will tell you, I know what it's like to be a woman walking into a bar full of guys.
Oh, did you feel cheap?
Oh, man. You'd be like, you know, you'd walk into the chow hall, and there'd be, you know, 50 women in there waiting for you to come in. And they'd be eyeing you. They'd be, like, scoping you out. And you'd be really uncomfortable sitting in the corner, like, And at night, you'd come out of the shower, you'd walk to your berthing room, and they'd be in the passageway, and they're like, hey, what's going on?
They'd snap you with a towel and stuff like that?
I just want to get to my berthing area. You know, you're like...
I'm sorry.
Okay, go ahead. Maybe like five of them in the hallway stagger through, so you got to go against them, and they're like,
hey, what's up? Yeah, I somehow imagine I'm having problems with picturing you like that. No, but it would be, yeah, back in the day, you know, you'd hear. I remember when we deployed to the Straits of Hormuz, and this is before carriers. When Mike and I were on sea duty, carriers didn't go into the Persian Gulf. You didn't go past the Iranian silkworm missiles that were, you know, surface-to-ship missiles that were sitting right at the Straits of Hormuz. You didn't do that. We didn't do that until the Persian Gulf War. And we stopped in the Philippines on our way out there. We stopped off the coast of Hawaii, but we didn't have a port visit. We just helicoptered stuff off and on. We then head to the Philippines. We're in port in the Philippines for 2 days, and then we had to go to sea because there was a typhoon. We had 2 days in Singapore on the way out there. And then, no, we didn't have any days. And we, so from, for the Philippines, when we went to sea for the typhoon, because that's what you do, you don't stay in port because you'll, the ship gets smashed and so will the pier. So everybody goes to sea. We went to the Indian Ocean and we cross deck with either the Kitty Hawk or the Constellation. You both, are sitting there and you're doing this vertical replenishment by helicopters. And you're cross-decking all the ordnance and everything that you can from one ship to another as they pass in the Indian Ocean. We do that, and then we're at sea for, I want to say, 104 straight days before we head back. We start our journey back. And
right.
So we're on our way back to the United States, and a technician came on, female technician, came on. Now this is like what 6,000 guys on an aircraft carrier back in the day, and they fly her out to work on this E2C Hawkeye. So it's the AWACS carrier plane. Okay, so it's turboprop, big dish on top, gets launched, gets up in the sky when you start flight ops, helicopter launches. First, then the E2C Hawkeye gets up there, data links everybody, and then everything goes. So that's how we used to do it. So she comes out to work on it, and she's a good-looking woman. And I remember coming around the corner, and there was a question of would we have security outside of her door, of her stateroom, and the answer was yes. So there was a Marine posted there. And I just remember I came around the corner and she was like a foot away from me. And so she went by me real quick and I just stopped. And when you haven't smelled a woman in like 4 months, just the smell of, you know, like her hair spray, her deodorant, I just stopped. And I didn't know this, but that doctor Barnaby was down the passageway and I stopped and I just went. And he looked at me, and he yells at me, and he yells, "What the fuck are you? What the fuck are you doing?" And I looked at him and I said, "I don't want to hear a male voice right now, okay, sir. So please leave me be." And so I walked out, and he's laughing, and he said, "That's nice, isn't it?" I said, "Well, I don't know if she's a good-looking girl, but the smell—that's what a woman smells like." He's like, "Yeah, it's crazy how your body gets used to not being around them." And I said, "Yeah, so." Back in the day, we did not. So, how long were they on the Kitty Hawk?
That whole about a 4.5 month move because we did all the hardship stuff. So we had to go to like the Bahamas. We went to Brazil. We went to Argentina, Chile, all the port calls, all the hard port calls in South America. To,
wow,
yeah.
The Love Boat, man. What a crew. That's awesome. I met guys who did that. I think they did that with the Ranger. They formed up when it was in SLEP in Philadelphia, and then they sailed around Latin America. They said it was awesome.
It was after dinner, you take a walk. You go up to the crow's nest, watch flight ops, you know, sitting there under the moon, relaxing, listening to Jet's Cat and Trap on the deck, and then, yeah. Go catch a movie. So
funny. Sea duty. What's the craziest thing you ever saw on sea duty? It could be climatic. It could be something on a ship. Give me one crazy thing you saw on sea duty.
Well, that I told you a story when we were in Argentina. We were in Mar del Plata, and we had the Marine Corps birthday ball, and we stayed out there the whole time. And so I waited until, like, you know, last minute to get to the ship, like the launches. And so when we got back, the ship was gone. So, I mean, we were walking down the pier and the ship was gone. I mean, you couldn't miss an aircraft carrier sitting right off the coast. And there was nothing there. And me and my buddy, Maurice, Mo, we looked at each other like, oh shit. And so when we got to the edge of the pier, there were some Navy guys still in, you know, their khakis, and they said, hey, the ship had to leave because the swells were getting really bad, but so I can't just hang out. And then, when they, cause, you know, Liberty had been secured like at 11, And so it was like 10:58. So we're sitting there. There's probably like 30 or 40 Navy guys, and then just me and him were the only two Marines left. And so we were like, you know, screw this. Let's go back to, you know, these girls' places. So we went back to there, and we could see the ocean from where we were. So we were like, okay, once we see the ship start coming back, we'll run back to the pier. And so we waited. Nothing happened. Next thing you know, I'd fallen asleep, and then I woke up, and it was daylight. And I was like, oh, shit. You know, like, we missed movement. And so we got dressed and ran. I mean, we were hauling ass. We got to the pier, and those same Navy guys were all just sleeping on the pier all night. You know, and we asked the chief and said, oh, the ship hasn't come back yet? No, she's coming back right now. So the Navy guys that were there were like, where'd you guys go? We're like, well, we went back to these girls' place. And they're like, well, we were supposed to leave the pier. And I'm like, yeah, you guys weren't. We're Marines.
We don't. Your orders don't cover us. I mean, you know, I'll tell you, the craziest thing I still recall is just the power of the ocean when you're out in the middle of it. And I remember being up in the North Pacific, headed towards Korea. And I honestly thought like the Ranger was going to bust in two one night. I mean, the swells were gigantic, and it was like Gilligan's Island stuff, right? The SS Minnow getting thrown around. And on an aircraft carrier, if you can imagine what the sea has to be. And then the next day, they started taking damage reports from the destroyers and the escorts that were with us, and those things just got rocked. And they got jacked up. But I just never forgot the power of Mother Nature when you're out at sea. It's just gigantic, and it's pretty humbling that, you know, to think men in wooden ships like did that kind of stuff, and you're like, oh,
well, we went around Cape Horn when we were around in Chile, you know, South America, and the storms were so bad that we were up on the Admiral's Bridge because we had no Admiral on board, so it was vacant, and that, you know, so it's the Admiral's Bridge is right below the Captain's Bridge. And so we're sitting there watching these waves. This front of the Kitty Hawk would lift all the way up, come all the way down, and slam, and the wave would go over the top of the ship and go down the flight deck. So, yeah,
if you can imagine 40,
50, 50 foot waves, you know. And that, to me, was just like, good God. You know, watching that ship struggle through those. I mean, that big of a ship struggle through those waves.
Now, think about that. That's a 1,000-foot ship that's struggling in the ocean. And the destroyers,
yeah,
man, when they're trying to do plane guard, or normally you have a destroyer, you know, at the view, and you're watching that thing, and it is rocking left and right and left and right. You're just going like, holy smokes, what must it be like to be on that thing, and the power of Mother Nature, man.
Well, I was on a Coast Guard cutter for about a month.
Why?
And, well, we were doing anti-narcotic stuff down in the Caribbean. And, we got into a storm, and that cutter would hit the water. You couldn't go outside to be washed away. The waves were coming over the whole ship. I mean, it was just like, oh, that was pretty tricky. That was before the Coast Guard had guns.
They're a war fighting organization now, even though they're not part of the DOD.
Right.
Right, right, right. All right, man. Any big plans today?
No. Yesterday I washed the truck, and then and it was hot. But no, today, no, not at all.
Wow, you're not digging the whole hot thing, are you?
I don't like the heat, man. It reminds me. Yeah, I don't do well in the heat. Cold? I love the cold.
Ugh.
Love it.
The heat. And where have you spent a lot of your life? Iraq, Afghanistan, Hey, it's 100. Yeah. It's 120, but it's a dry 120.
Yeah, right.
That.
And you don't have body armor on, and you're not drinking hot water out of the Camelback. Yeah. And oh, by the way, they're trying to kill you. You know. So yeah, it can always be worse, man.
But one of the things that is interesting, we rarely medevac people as heat casualties. And most of the time when we did, it was because they were taking those fucking supplements or drinking Rip-Its or some shit like that.
Rip-Its, Red Line.
Yeah, but most of the time, you'd be surprised. The amount of weight, the amount of time guys are walking on patrols, and the temperature, and, you know, your body, you know, adjusts to it. And it's truly astounding. And I swear to God, 99% of the time, if we medevac somebody as a heat casualty, first of all, people would just stop and say, what? A heat casualty? Yeah. Are you shitting me? And it would be because of eating supplements. Because they were, you know, they were trying to get all rocked up to go home to their girlfriend or whatever. But it was crazy. Otherwise, I mean, it was amazing. You know, they'd get out there every day and do their shit, and no medevac.
No, I'm not in the wrong state.
Yeah.
Rod, I'm in the right state.
Montana Man says, you're the wrong state if you don't like heat. I didn't want to say that because I didn't feel like it was appropriate, but I'm glad he did. But you only got another probably 4 weeks of it, and maybe about half.
I mean, it's just I'm not a big fan of it. I mean, I'll go out in it, it's fine, but I'm not a big fan of it. But no, if this is the sacrifice I have to pay to live in a great state like this, then it's worth it.
Well, listen to him waving the flag now. All right, that'll be enough. You have a good day.
All right, I'll talk to you later, man.
You know what? I did not know Mookie Betts was as good as he is.
He's great.
He's pretty good. I was listening to, you know, they have so many different statistics in baseball now. It's kind of crazy. Mookie Betts, on balls that he hits, he puts more baseballs in play than any other guy in Major League Baseball. So when he decides to swing, he puts the ball in play, it was like 45% of the time. And that includes, you know, foul balls and things like that. I mean, which is an amazing feat for a hitter. But, yeah, he's a pretty good baseball player.
Yeah, he is.
There you go. Boston Red Sox. Boston Red Sox. How much does it hurt to say that? Lots.
I know.
All right,
man. I'll talk to her.
There you have it. From the great state of Texas, the one and only Michael Musselman, born and raised in Eden Prairie, Minnesota, lived for a while in San Diego, California, where he spent a lot of his time, almost all of his time in the Marine Corps, and now living in the great state of Texas. So, I have one more comment. The president said to Phoenix tonight, I'm getting a little sick and tired of all this violence, because people are pissed off at whatever they're pissed off at. So I hope the Phoenix police, the idiots that, just like they over the weekend in Boston, there were some people that they wanted to start trouble. I hope the Phoenix police lays the wood to those assholes. You can come and protest anything in peace. Right? You can sing All We Are Saying is Give Peace a Chance. You know, you don't have the right to fuck up our city, and we're sick of it. And so, unlike what happens in Charlottesville when the city council chamber gets taken over and all the rest of that nonsense, Charlottesville, honestly, an embarrassment. You know, there's a reason we have cops, to keep things organized. So, I hope that if it gets out of hand, that I hope the Phoenix police step in and they restore order. And we all learn in this country that you can protest peacefully. And again, the visuals, there's 50 idiots spouting bullshit, and there's 15,000 people. Like, do you need to make a greater statement than that? I'm not sure. So, anyway, that'll do it on a Tuesday edition. Yeah, cue the music. All right, my thanks to John Ubaldi for coming on. My thanks to you for listening. We're going to talk coffee tomorrow. Jarhead Java going to rejoin us again. And we'll also talk to... we'll also talk about Afghanistan again tomorrow. So, join us tomorrow. Have a great day this afternoon. Jarhead Java, you can find it at TJ Maxx. This program repeats itself momentarily, so don't touch that dial if you missed the first part of it. In the news today, let me just tell you what we cover. We'll talk about the president's speech on Afghanistan. We talk about rules of engagement in Afghanistan. We update the USS McCain situation where they found remains. And you'll even get a little bit of a world slavery, a little bit of education. So, slavery by the numbers. We'll do more numbers on slavery tomorrow, where they came from, where they went. As we paint a full picture of America's history with slavery. Have a great day. All Marine Radio, out.